It is good to be back again. It's been a couple weeks with Thanksgiving. Hope you all had a good Thanksgiving. It was nice to see the snow, nice not to have to be out in the snow. But it does seem like we're getting a decent amount of it this year, so it's nice. I prefer the warm, but it'll come around again, right? Anyway, tonight, the book of Malachi. The last of our series, the last study we will be doing together in a survey of the Old Testament. It's been over a year now with 38 lessons, and we'll jump right into it. But I think this book is really important, kind of brings together all the Old Testament and looks forward to the coming New Testament, even though the people who received the original message wouldn't have known that it was coming or when it was coming exactly. So, Malachi, the name means messenger. And because this name is such an unusual name for people in the Old Testament, some have speculated that it's merely a pseudonym, so a false name, and not actually the prophet's name. And, you know, we really don't have any other background information about Malachi. And the name is unique to the book. So there are some reasons why a person might suppose that was the case. But I do believe that this book probably follows the normal pattern of all the other minor prophets and the other prophets, the major prophets, where the author identifies himself with his name and then goes on to state his message. And I think for that reason, we will say Malachi was indeed the author's name. The subtitle for the book is From One Messenger to Another. And when you look at that, there are, well, you might think I'm talking about something that's being communicated from one messenger to another, and I am. That is the primary thrust of this whole book. Malachi, the messenger, is speaking to the priests. A lot of the book is focused at the priests. And in chapter 2, verse 7 of Malachi, God tells them that they were his messengers, but they had failed. For the priest's lips should keep knowledge, and they should seek the law at his mouth, for he is the messenger of the Lord of hosts. So the priests were to be messengers for the Lord, but they had failed. So one reason I chose the subtitle, From a Prophet Whose Name Meant Messenger, is coming a message to the messengers that God had designated for his people. But there's kind of a play on words here, intentionally, because another purpose of the book of Malachi, the next in the prophetic line, who was John the Baptist. So this book forms a gap, time-wise, from Malachi, one messenger, to the next. This other messenger comes up in the book of Malachi, called a messenger, in chapter 3, Verse 1, Behold, I will send my messenger, and he shall prepare the way before me. And the Lord whom ye seek shall suddenly come to his temple, even the messenger of the covenant whom ye delight in. Behold, he shall come, saith the Lord of hosts. So the messenger will come to prepare the way for the Lord, and that messenger is going to be the next prophet, the next one to bring revelation from God after hundreds of years of silence. The summary of the book, Malachi is communicating God's final condemnation on a rebellious people before the 400 silent years begin. The date? Well, you could probably piece together from 400 silent years and Christ coming at the end of that time. We're talking about late 400s BC. Some textual evidence suggests that Malachi wrote roughly the same time as Nehemiah. And that would be the corruption in the priesthood. If you have your Bibles, go ahead and turn to Malachi. We'll be there for the lesson tonight. But we will also be looking at a few other verses. Malachi 1, 7 through 10 demonstrates that the priests had become very corrupt. Ye offer polluted bread upon mine altar, and ye say, Wherein have we polluted thee? In that ye say, the table of the Lord is contemptible. And if ye offer the blind for sacrifice, is it not evil? And if ye offer the lame and sick, is it not evil? Offer it now unto thy governor, will he be pleased with thee, or accept thy person, saith the Lord of hosts? And now, I pray you, beseech God that he will be gracious unto us. This hath been by your means. Will he regard your persons, saith the Lord of hosts? So the people were corrupt in what they were offering to God. And if we look back at Nehemiah chapter 13, you don't have to turn there if you don't want to. I will and read a couple verses. Nehemiah chapter 13, verses 4 through 7. And before this, Eliashib the priest, having the oversight of the chamber of the house of our God, was allied unto Tobiah, and he had prepared for him a great chamber, where aforetime they laid the meat offerings, the frankincense, and the vessels, and the tithes of the corn, and the new wine, and the oil, which was commanded to be given to the Levites, and the singers, and the porters, and the offerings of the priests. But in all this time was not I at Jerusalem. So during Nehemiah's absence, there was corruption in the priesthood. In both Malachi, a large portion of his message is targeted at the corrupt priesthood, and that would seem to fit with the gap of time when Nehemiah was not in Jerusalem. Another of the themes that comes up in this book is intermarriage with the Canaanites. Nehemiah 13, 23 and 28, 23 through 28, discuss that. In those days also saw I Jews that had married wives of Ashdod, of Ammon, and of Moab. And their children spake half in the speech of Ashdod and could not speak in the Jews' language, but according to the language of each people. And then in Malachi 2, 11 through 16, we see the priests divorcing their wives. Judah hath dealt treacherously, and an abomination is committed in Israel and in Jerusalem. For Judah hath profaned the holiness of the Lord, which he loved, and hath married the daughter of a strange god. So in Nehemiah, he's describing the people going off and marrying daughters of Ammon, which had been a primary reason the people were corrupted in the first place, way back when. And now again, in Malachi, he's describing how the people are going and marrying these wives that were devoted to the false gods. So Malachi probably wrote for these textual reasons. We can assume that, but then also just from tradition, that he probably wrote during the 12 years that Nehemiah was gone to Babylon, or around 430 BC. In Nehemiah 13:6, but in all this time was not I at Jerusalem, for in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, came I unto the king, and after certain days obtained I leave of the king. So the background of the book is Nehemiah's 12-year absence. That time, apart from having a good leader, really set up the people to begin going their own way once again. Nehemiah, when he originally came up with his business proposal for the king of Babylon and said he wanted to go to Jerusalem and rebuild the walls, was given a certain amount of time to do this. And after he presented his time to the king and went to Jerusalem, built the walls, was governor for a time, he did go back to Babylon and perform his duties to the king again. While he was there, we just read that verse in chapter 13, verse 6. He was there for a short time, but then he came back. That short time was actually 12 years, and during those 12 years, the people, especially the priests, for some reason, the priests were especially prone to this sin at this time, they began to drift away from God. And Malachi was God's messenger to the people of Israel during Nehemiah, their governor's absence, to try to bring them back to the right standing with him. The key people in the book are the priests and Elijah. Where does Elijah come in? I thought he was way back in the Old Testament a long time ago. Well, we'll get there in a minute. Let's look at the priest first. The priests were turning people away from righteousness to iniquity. And we won't read all the verses that are in there right now. You're more than welcome to later. We'll look at them in a few minutes as we work through the overview. I put them in there primarily for reference if you wanted to go back at some other time. In chapter 2, verse 6, we find that they were turning people away from righteousness to iniquity, Then a couple verses later, they themselves had fallen out of the way. They were also divorcing their wives. And that follows right on the heels of the statement that the people were marrying the gods of the daughters of the strange gods. So these people, these priests, were divorcing their wives and marrying these pagan wives. But then the priests also are important because in chapter 3, there is a prophecy of their purification by, not the future messenger, but by the Lord who the messenger foretold. And the second key person in this book is Elijah. Elijah is the prophet who will come before the day of the Lord, as he is featured in this book. Let's look at chapter 4, verses 5 and 6. Behold, I will send you Elijah, the prophet, before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. And he shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children, and the heart of the children to their fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. Now Elijah, if you'll remember back to the period of the kings, lived a long time ago, but he never died. And God is promising as a sign of the day of the Lord that it will be coming soon, that Elijah the prophet will come and preach to the nation, and through his preaching, he will turn the heart of the fathers back to the children and the children to the fathers, bringing a great revival. Although the entire nation is addressed in the book, the priests are probably the most focused target, the primary audience, and they are addressed in a large portion. Moving on to the overview, begins, like most of the other minor prophets, with an introduction, a very short introduction. He is Malachi, and he has a message for the people of Israel. The burden of the word of the Lord to Israel by Malachi. And beyond that, we know nothing of the person himself, except for his time when he was speaking. He begins right off with establishing proof of God's love for Israel in 2 through 5 of chapter 1. And how is this demonstrated? That's a question that God asks the people of Israel. He asks them to think. Remember back to Jacob and Esau. Jacob I loved, but Esau I hated, as we find in the New Testament. And that looks like this, as he describes here. Esau was permanently destroyed for their wickedness, in verse 3. And I hated Esau and laid his mountains and his heritage waste for the dragons of the wilderness. Whereas Edom saith, we are impoverished, but we will return and build the desolate places. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, they shall build, but I will throw down. And they shall call them the border of wickedness and the people against whom the Lord hath indignation forever. Edom committed a grave sin in turning against God. They were, remember, they were actually part of the lineage that God had called out of the false, when God called Abraham out, they were descendants of Abraham. They knew the truth, but they turned away from it. And when they turned away from it, God permanently destroyed them. But Israel was only temporarily punished. And your eyes shall see, and ye shall say, the Lord will be magnified from the border of Israel. Israel had offended God time and time again, and God had judged them time and time again, but yet his mercy never ran out for this people. So Malachi begins by establishing proof that God loves Israel. But then he continues right on by showing how the priests had profaned the altar. I read the verse earlier that described how the table was made contemptible and then how they offered corrupt sacrifices. Instead of trying to give their best to God, they were taking the blind, the lame, things they wouldn't even consider giving to their government, they were offering to God. They knew their government wasn't going to be accepted with a damaged sacrifice, a damaged offering. And God says, why would you offer that to me? I'm your God. Not even a government, I'm your God. So much greater than your government. But even though the people in Israel were offering corrupt sacrifices. At the end of the chapter, we find a statement that God's name will be great among the Gentiles. For from the rising of the sun, even unto the going down of the same, my name shall be great among the Gentiles. So although the people of Israel were lacking in their offerings to God, the people around the world would glorify him as God eventually. The next section, chapter 2, is a curse on the priesthood. They will be cursed if they do not change their ways. If ye will not hear, and if ye will not lay it to heart, to give glory unto my name, saith the Lord of hosts, I will even send a curse upon you, and I will curse your blessings. Yea, I have cursed them already, because ye do not lay it to heart. The priests were supposed to be people designated by God that were seeking knowledge in 2 verse 7. For the priest's lips should keep knowledge, and they should seek the law at his mouth, for he is the messenger of the Lord of hosts. But instead of seeking that knowledge so that they could then pass it along to their people, they had corrupted the people. In verse 8, but ye are departed out of the way. Ye have caused many to stumble at the law. Ye have corrupted the covenant of Levi, saith the Lord of hosts. And through all of this, one of the main demonstrations of their wickedness and their corruption was that they were breaking their marriage vows. In chapter 2, 14 through 16. Yet ye say, wherefore? Because the Lord hath been witness between thee and the wife of thy youth, against whom thou hast dealt treacherously. Yet is she thy companion and the wife of thy covenant? And did not he make one? Yet had he the residue of the Spirit, and wherefore one, that he might seek a godly seed? Therefore take heed to your spirit, and let none deal treacherously against the wife of his youth. For the Lord, the God of Israel, saith that he hateth putting away. For one covereth violence with his garment, saith the Lord of hosts. Therefore take heed to your spirit, that ye deal not treacherously. Now I think it's appropriate here just to break off for a moment and say that God hates divorce, and it's always been that way. Sometimes when we look back at the Old Testament and we see the immorality that was there, and just it almost might seem like it was passed by, but God's very clearly saying here he hates divorce, and he has always hated it. He planned for marriage to be between one man and one woman. Continuing on, all of this, they wearied God with their wickedness. Yet have ye wearied the Lord with your words. Yet ye say, wherein have we wearied him? When ye say, every one that doeth evil is good in the sight of the Lord, and he delighteth in them. Or, where is the God of judgment? The people were wearying God because they said evil was good. And they denied that God would judge between the good and the evil. It shows how corrupt the priesthood had become in just a short amount of time here. We're talking a few years between when Nehemiah left and when he returned. In chapter 3, though, we see a turn up in how the future of the nation will be determined with the coming messenger that will prepare the way of the Lord. The messenger will prepare the way in verse 1 of chapter 3. Behold, I will send my messenger, and he shall prepare the way before me. And the Lord whom ye seek shall suddenly come to his temple, even the messenger of the covenant whom ye delight in. Behold, he shall come, saith the Lord of hosts. And the Lord, who is being foretold and prepared for by this messenger, the Lord will purify the sons of Levi. In 2 and 3. But who may abide the day of his coming? And who shall stand when he appeareth? For he is like a refiner's fire and like fuller's soap, and he shall sit as a refiner and purifier of silver. He shall purify the sons of Levi and purge them as gold and silver, that they may offer unto the Lord an offering in righteousness. And the Lord will judge the wicked. In verse 5, and I will come near to you to judgment, and I will be a swift witness against the sorcerers and against the adulterers and against false swearers, and against those that oppress the hireling in his wages, the widow, and the fatherless, and that turn aside the stranger from his right, and fear me not, saith the Lord of hosts. The coming messenger will prepare the way of the Lord. And when the Lord comes, he will set all of this problem with the priesthood right. He will purify the sons of Levi, and he will judge the wicked. And all that leads up to a plea to return to God. In the latter half of chapter 3, we see that God would restore the blessings that were offered to the nation if they returned to him. And the primary way that he requests and demands that they return to him is that they return to him in their tithes and their offerings. He says they had robbed God of their tithes. Will a man rob God? Yet have ye robbed me. But ye say, wherein have we robbed thee? In tithes and offerings. These are a very much expected part of the Israelite life and part of every Christian's life, truly. And God says that if they restored the tithes that they were holding back from him, God would restore the rain that he had been withholding. Bring ye all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be meat in mine house, and prove me now herewith, saith the Lord of hosts, if I will not open you the windows of heaven and pour you out a blessing, that there shall not be room enough to receive it. The blessing would come. He would bring the rain, the blessing, their fruit would grow, they would have enough and to spare, and the nations would call them blessed. And all nations, in verse 12, shall call you blessed, for ye shall be a delightsome land, saith the Lord of hosts. When they return to him, return the offerings, return the right worship to God, then he will bless them. And the end of chapter 3 and the beginning of chapter 4 is a contrast between those who are serving God and those who are not. But in this contrast, there's a question. Is it useless to serve God? Well, the first thought that is conveyed is that it is, in fact, useless to serve God. In verse 14 of chapter 3, ye have said, it is vain to serve God, and what profit is it that we have kept his ordinance and that we have walked mournfully before the Lord of hosts? What would cause someone to ask that kind of a question? Well, if you read in verse 15, we have the answer to that. Evil men seem to get off without a problem. And now we call the proud happy. Yea, they that work wickedness are set up. Yea, they that tempt God are even delivered. Sometimes when you look around at the world, it can seem like the people who are really doing wickedness just have everything perfect. They don't have to worry about the daily needs. They have everything they need. And because of that, this question comes to a lot of Christians' minds. What is with doing, why am I doing all this good stuff? Why am I trying to please God if the evil people don't have a problem? I have it harder when I'm trying to please God than the evil people do when they're not. But the answer is in verses 16 through 18, and that is that God does remember those who fear him. Then they that feared the Lord spake often one to another, and the Lord hearkened and heard it. And a book of remembrance was written before him for them that feared the Lord and that thought upon his name. And they shall be mine, saith the Lord of hosts, in that day when I make up my jewels, and I will spare them, as a man spareth his own son that serveth him. Then shall ye return and discern between the righteous and the wicked, between him that serveth God and him that serveth not. Why is it worth serving God when it looks like all the wicked are getting away scot-free? Because at the end, when God comes, he will remember all that you have done to serve him, and he will reward it. And then you can look in the end at the difference between the righteous and the wicked. And when you consider their end, it will all make sense. Because all the wicked will be destroyed in fire. In chapter 4, verse 1. For behold, the day cometh that shall burn as an oven, and all the proud, yea, all that do wickedly, shall be stubble. And the day shall come, and the day that cometh shall burn them up, saith the Lord of hosts, that it shall leave them neither root nor branch. But God's servants will increase. But unto you that fear my name shall the Son of Righteousness arise with healing in his wings, and ye shall go forth and grow up as calves of the stall. And ye shall tread down the wicked, for they shall be ashes under the soles of your feet in the day that I shall do this, saith the Lord of hosts. And the end of the book is again that prophecy of Elijah coming before the day of the Lord. The purpose of that coming was to bring revival for the nation of Israel. We read those verses earlier. Go ahead and read them again. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. And he shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children and the heart of the children to their fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. So that is it for the overview. As I read through the book, one word kept coming to my mind as very important. And I kind of brought it out in the introduction a little bit when we were talking about the title. That word is messenger. It's the prophet's name. That's what it means. But it's also the role that the priests were supposed to play for the people. They were supposed to be God's messengers to the people. And it's also foretelling the coming messenger who will prepare the way for the Lord. The messenger and the message is a key aspect of this book. It comes up as a message being sent from God to people who are failing in their role to take God's message to the people. It also comes up as a prophetic message looking forward to the messenger who will come, actually preparing the way of the Lord right before he comes. In just a second, we will look at who that messenger was. But before we get there, let's look at who the messenger is preparing for. Christ in the book of Malachi is the Lord who will purify the sons of Levi. We read those verses in chapter 3 a couple of times tonight. So we'll just look ahead into the New Testament for a few minutes and see how they were fulfilled. When Christ came to earth, he purified the temple quite literally in his first coming. So John chapter 2. John chapter 2, 13 through 16. And the Jews' Passover was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem and found in the temple those that sold oxen and sheep and doves and the changers of money sitting. And when he had made a scourge of small cords, he drove them all out of the temple, and the sheep and the oxen, and poured out the changers' money, and overthrew the tables. And he said unto them that sold doves, take these things hence, make not my Father's house an house of merchandise. In his first coming, he very literally purified the temple from the corrupt business practices that were happening. In the second coming, however, he will purify the entire nation of Israel. Let's turn to Romans 11:26. Romans 11:26. And so all Israel shall be saved. As it is written, there shall come out of Zion the deliverer, and he shall turn away ungodliness from Jacob. Not only will he purify Israel, but when between the time when he comes the first time and the second time, he will offer that purifying to all the nations who come to him. This is what is called the time of the Gentiles in the verse just preceding Romans 11:26 and verse 25. For I would not, brethren, that ye should be ignorant of this mystery, lest ye should be wise in your own conceits, that blindness in part is happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in. So between the two comings, the Gentiles are coming to Christ, and he is offering that purification to them. The first time, Christ will come and purify the temple. In the second coming, he will purify the whole nation of Israel. All those that are living, all the Jews who are living in Israel at that time will be saved. Between those two comings, however, he is offering that purification to all the nations who come to him. So Christ is the Lord who will purify the sons of Levi, but he will also purify all those who come to him without limit. The key theme is to give of your tithes. So Giving of tithes is a constant problem after the return of the exile. All three of the minor prophets that were written after the Jews returned discussed this theme, giving of tithes. And we have to ask, after such repetition, did the message succeed? Did they start giving their tithes? Well, if we look ahead, again, going to the New Testament, Matthew 23:23, we find that the Pharisees did indeed practice tithing to perfection, quote-unquote perfection. Let's look at that verse. "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For ye pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin, and have omitted the weightier matters of the law, judgment, mercy, and faith. These ought ye to have done, and not to leave the other undone." So the Pharisees, they were masters of showmanship, offering tithes on even their mint, their herbs that they had. But yet, while they were doing these minute actions, they were failing to get the heart right. They failed to understand the core of Malachi's message. That is that God doesn't just want the money. He wants the heart of the giver. The next couple verses there following that description of what the Pharisees were doing, 24 through 26. "Ye blind guides, which strain at a gnat and swallow a camel. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For ye make clean the outside of the cup and of the platter, but within they are full of extortion and excess. Thou blind Pharisee, cleanse first that which is within the cup and platter, that the outside of them may be clean also." So God didn't want them just to look good. That's not why he gave all these laws in the Old Testament. He gave the laws and expected the people's hearts to follow the laws. The Pharisees were not at all doing that. Instead, I think we have a good demonstration of what God does want in a description of a woman. Mark chapter 12, verses 41 through 44. "And Jesus sat over against the treasury and beheld how the people cast money into the treasury, and many that were rich cast in much. And there came a certain poor widow, and she threw in two mites, which make a farthing. And he called unto him his disciples and saith unto them, Verily I say unto you, that this poor widow hath cast more in than all they which have cast into the treasury. For all they did cast in of their abundance, but she of her want did cast in all that she had, even all her living." The heart of this woman reflected several things. First, it reflected her love for God, because she was willing to make a clear sacrifice, even though she hadn't thrown in a lot of money. The sincerity of her gift was far more important to Jesus than the amount that she was giving. Second, it reflected her trust in God. A woman of this poverty level would not have had a very good income. So that little amount of money, as insignificant as it might have seemed, would have been very important to her. And she still gave it to God. I'm confident that God did not let her starve. As a matter of fact, she probably had discovered in the past, through her giving to God, that God took care of her needs when she demonstrated her love for him. And then that in turn led her to worshiping him more freely with her giving and being willing to give more to him, even all her worldly possessions, as Jesus said. In this case, the heart of the giver is seen in its importance. So let me just ask a question before we move on. How is your heart when you give to God? Are you willing to make a sacrifice that is precious to you, or do you just skim off the very top and give a cheap item that is blemished because it will least hinder your financial status? That's what the Jews in Malachi were doing. They were giving to God. They were giving an animal. It might have been blind. It might have been missing a leg, but they were giving an animal. But as they tried to keep the best for themselves, God took more than they could afford from their income. He didn't give them the stuff that they needed to prosper. But then he offered them a decision to be made by faith. Will you offer me the tithes I demand? If so, I will bless you bountifully. We read that at the end of chapter 2. Many here could no doubt express the same truth from personal experience about how God gives back to those who give to Him. One way you demonstrate your love for God is by willingly designating your resources for His service. So God doesn't just want the money. He wants the heart of the giver. The challenge to Malachi. Who is Elijah? Well, this person will come before the day of the Lord. Well, first, Elijah was obviously a real person. He lived during the time of the kings. He was a prophet. He did miracles. And he interacted with the kings, was a witness for God to the people. Elijah will come before the day of the Lord. And this prophecy was partially fulfilled in Christ's first coming with John the Baptist, who came before Christ the first time. But it will not be completely fulfilled until the ministry of the two witnesses in Revelation, when Elijah will in fact come back, will be sent back by God to be a witness, and he will preach to the nation. And during that time, when he is preaching, he will return the heart of the fathers to the children and bring a great revival to the land. So much so that when Christ comes back, they will see him and believe. The entire nation, even though it's been greatly purified and reduced to a third of the number of the people that were there originally, the entire nation will believe at that time. So moving along to application now for sake of time, I just want to return really quick to that thought we discussed at the end of chapter 3 and the beginning of chapter 4. Have you ever wondered how the wicked seem to succeed while the righteous struggle? And be encouraged, because that is a legitimate question. It comes up at least twice that I know of in the Bible, twice that we're going to reference tonight. I guess I should say that. We looked at it in Malachi. Let's turn to Psalm 73 to see how Asaph, the psalm writer, struggled with this same question. So in his description of the evil people, verses 3 through 5, he says that he doesn't understand how they have it easy in life and don't have to worry about anything. For I was envious at the foolish when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. For there are no bands in their death, but their strength is firm. They are not in trouble as other men, neither are they plagued like other men. And it's very easy to think when you look at how the evil people in this world just seem to be getting away with everything. And in verse 6, he describes them as being lifted up with pride. Therefore, because they're getting away with everything and they don't see that there is a judge or a day of judgment coming, therefore, pride compasseth them about as a chain, violence covereth them as a garment. They're even getting away with violence. And when you look at this, it can be very difficult to understand. Not only are they getting away with stuff, because they're getting away with stuff, they're blatantly mocking God in verse 11. And they say, how doth God know? And is there knowledge in the Most High? That might seem bad. It might seem hard to understand. But Asaph, in this psalm, progresses from questions to confidence. Verses 13 through 14. Looking at the comparison between the wicked and the righteous in this way, it does seem like there is no reason to be righteous, and that cleansing is done in vain. That's where we picked up in Malachi, verses 13 through 14. Verily, I have cleansed my heart in vain and washed my hands in innocency. For all the day long have I been plagued and chastened every morning. It seems useless if they're getting away with everything and you, by your sacrifice to God, are struggling. But when he ends his psalm, he realizes that this thought is too painful until you understand their end. Until I went unto the sanctuary of God, then I understood their end. And in the sanctuary, one would presume that he is learning about how God will reward those who trust him, those who love him, I think of Romans 8:28. All things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are the called according to his purpose. And when you understand the end of the wicked, then you will understand why it is so important to be holy in your life. Do not envy the wicked, because their end will be terrible. We read about it in Malachi chapter 4, verse 1. They will be burned with a fire, destroyed, utterly consumed. And while they are destroyed, the righteous will be exalted. The question is then, are you willing to give up the pleasures of the current time for the future triumph of the holy? Malachi clarified their end for us. They will be burned in the fire, and all that they have done in wickedness will be destroyed as well. So it's not just the wicked, it's their actions. Whereas the actions that are good will be built and last forever. So if this is a challenge that has ever occurred to you at some point in your life, and you've ever wondered about how the wicked can get away with everything, let's allow God's ability to judge the wicked to give us confidence as we pursue a pure lifestyle. When it comes down to it, it's really not our responsibility to do the actions of another person. The wicked are responsible for their own actions. But what God is doing, as we found in Malachi, is that he is literally keeping a record of those who fear him. And one day there will be an end of their worries because the wicked ones will be judged. How then should we be living? Well, we should continue our lives in holiness, continue to live righteously, and be confident that he will be the rewarder of them that diligently seek him. And as we know that to be true, that should give us confidence and not worry, not fear, as we look at the wicked. All right, thank you very much for staying with us in this series through a year, the survey of the Old Testament. We will resume, as my dad said, in January with the book of Matthew, a survey of the New Testament. Hope to see you back then, but thank you very much for coming tonight. At this time, we will divide up for prayer.